Welcome to Feels Like Healing, a series of conversations between myself, Al Lewis, and individuals who have turned to creativity as a way of helping them heal. Our need for healing is universal, however, the reasons behind it can be oh so varied. A difficult childhood, a traumatic experience, or perhaps a bereavement and our need to process grief. My search for healing stems from the death of my dad, who died when I was 21 from multiple sclerosis. I believe that hearing other people's stories can help us to process ours, and that the act of being creative can help turn something seemingly hopeless and incomprehensible into something beautiful and hopeful. These conversations are here to provide solace and inspiration, and to show you that healing can happen when we take our deepest pain and turn it into a work of art. This is Feels Like Healing. My guest this week on Feels Like Healing is the Welsh journalist, lecturer, arts critic, and now author, Jew Rogers. Her debut book, The Sound of Being Human, came out last year, and having read the book, I felt like it is a book that is very pertinent to the subject matter that we discuss here on this podcast, because as you find out at the very beginning of the book, Jude loses her dad tragically when she's 5 years old. This then starts her journey on discussing her relationship between her grief and also the music that colours and contextualises the rest of her life. It's been a fascinating read, and I'm delighted that Jude is here to talk more about the book and her story. So, hello Jude, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm very good. I almost said, hey Jude, then, and that would have been...
No, do you know what? Just do it. It's fine. I don't mind. It's when people sing a whole verse or sing a whole chorus and think I've never heard it before. That's when it's a little grating, but honestly, I don't mind.
But I love how in the book you said that you interviewed Sir Paul McCartney and that he had a little giggle when he said your name, did he?
Yeah, he did. I've had him and also Dolly Parton sang Hey Jude on the phone at me, which I don't have the recording of, which I should have, because that should have been, you know, my voicemail, you know, message.
That would be the coolest voicemail.
Yeah, so intimidated. It's like, oh, okay.
As I've just alluded to in that brief introduction, your book is part memoir, but also you did a lot of research, didn't you, into humanity's relationship with music. So before we sort of go back to your early childhood, so what was the initial decision-making process for you about why you wanted to write this book?
To go into the science stuff. Well, it's funny, I think I've been writing personally about music for lots of years when I had the opportunity to. And the actual trigger for it was when Mark Hollis from Talk Talk died. I write a chapter that begins with me mm-hmm. getting this commission to, you know, write about this musician that I really loved, you know, just after he died. And I wrote a piece and it was very personal. It got lots of feedback and I realised I love writing about music like that. And when people are connecting with a piece of writing, because it's because of their emotional relationship with music. And I suddenly thought I could do this about so many things in my life. And I realised I'd already sort of been doing that in little pieces and the columns over the years. But with the science, sort of delving more deeply into it, it was just because, you know, I'd always be fascinated with, you know, why is it that if I hear a certain song, then it, you know, transports me back straight away to a place or a person, a memory. Why is it that certain songs just make us want to dance straight away? Why is it that music can be such a comfort to us when we're very low or we've gone through something very tough in our lives? And just knowing from my years of, you know, going to gigs and clubs and wedding discos and everything, you know, how music is such an incredible social glue. And I wanted to know a little bit more, you know, I guess just being a journalist, I wanted to dig into, you know, why is this the case? You know, I knew I wasn't, you know, I'm not a scientist, but I can interview people. So I interviewed loads of people who knew more about that. So, and I found that fascinating, you know, interviewing neuroscientists, psychologists, you know, go a little bit into anthropology, amazing lecturer at Cardiff University, was an expert in fandom and cultures around fandom, you know, just to kind of open up that for myself. You know, I could have written a book that was just a plain memoir, but I wanted to answer questions for myself and for other people as well.
No, that's what I found really interesting, was that you had peppered it with those academics that you talked to. And yeah, it wasn't just your story, even though your story is compelling. It sort of gives well, myself as the reader, it gave you more of a insight into why we all experience these things, like you said, why music is such a powerful tool to help us express ourselves, or as a society to express a moment in history. Fascinating. Yeah. So if I take you back then to the beginning of the book and you talk about losing your dad, it struck me because you said you were 5 and a half. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
That's the age that my eldest daughter is right now. And therefore thinking of that, and we'll talk a bit later about how that milestone affected you when your son hit that age as well. But if we just talk about you first, you mentioned in the book that you felt after that point, you psychologically very different to all your friends because you'd experienced something so traumatic at such a young age. Was writing an immediate solace for you back then? Were you always a kid who liked to write and create, or
yes.
Or was it something later on?
No, I was a writer from, you know, back then. You know, it's funny because I didn't become a writer, you know, unless, yeah, the idea, when I say that, I mean, you know, had a job getting paid for it, but that's not what becoming a writer is. You don't have to just get paid to become a writer. I became a writer when I was 25, professionally. I was writing straight away. My mum's a primary school teacher, and she always talks about when I was a little kid, she went back to teaching about a year after my dad died, and she used to bring back West Glamorgan County Council exercise books with the kids in school. And there'd always be a few that were a bit dog-eared, or, you know, they couldn't give to the kids. And she'd give them to me and I just fill them up. You know, I used to love things in school when you were just studying a book and the teacher would say, write to the end, right, finish the chapter off. And I would fill a book. And my mum would always say in the summer, you know, I'm such a South Walian, you know, I didn't want to go outside. It was too hot. I wanted to be inside, you know, reading magazines or writing. And my mum bought a desk, like a really old fashioned desk with an inkwell, like from a neighbour who was going to put me outside, because that's the only way she'd get me outside. I was writing all the time. And, you know, not... It wasn't all, you know, I found some of the things, you know, I always make little lift the flap books for my little brother and stuff like that. It wasn't like these profound, you know, things that show, you know, the trauma I was going through. But, you know, just all these, you know, little girl stories, really.
But did you realise you were different to other kids your age in being so into that? Or did you have fellow friends that were also into that, or was it quite a solitary exercise?
No, it was really solitary, and it wasn't until I really started writing the book and thinking about music. You know, the third chapter of it is about Adam and the Ants, Prince Charming, and a kind of, which is music, and Adam and the Ants and Wham and a few other bands I got into after Dad. They were the first music I really remember after Dad died. I did write stories about them as well. They were kind of in the mix as well, but I was quite fascinated with Adam Ant. But yeah, that wasn't something I shared with friends. I don't remember ever talking to my friends about, oh, this is great Prince Charming character, and I saw him, you know, going live or whatever it was, Saturday Swap Shop. No, it was really solitary. You know, my younger brother, I've got two brothers now, but one of my brothers was 4.5 years younger than me, so he was very little when my dad died, just over a year. And I felt, I don't know, you know, we're close now, but yeah, I felt I was in my own little world, really, at that age, just this sort of world of the imagination.
Did it feel comforting to you?
Oh,
that process of creating, was that a comfort?
Absolutely.
Did you realise that?
Yeah, I don't know if I did realise it, but I just had to do it. Mm. I just, you know, when I think about my childhood and my adolescence, I think about me in my bedroom just writing in, you know, notebooks I bought from Woolworths. And just the covers change. You know, it might be a William Morris pattern when I'm a teenager because I'm trying to be a bit arty, or it might be, you know, something cool, or, you know, whatever. But, I loved decorating my room with pictures, cutting things out and sticking it on the wall, and I loved writing and I loved reading. But it's funny, I'm a freelance journalist and I have been for 15 years nearly, and I know, you know, it's me being by myself writing again. It's the same.
At what point did you ever consider it being a feasible life choice? Did you ever talk about that with your mum and with teachers, or was it just sort of something you stumbled into because it was the thing you loved doing the most?
Oh, I stumbled into it. I always wanted to do it, but I didn't have the confidence to do it, is the truth. I found a careers book you had to fill in from comprehensive school, like in my third year when you're picking your GCSE options, and I write in it, I want to be a journalist. You know, and it's funny, it's people like Kate Adie I used to see on TV. I remember, you know, when the disaster in Tiananmen Square and things like that, I'd see people like Kate Adie, I thought, right, that's what I want to do. I want to be, you know, one of those journalists. But as I got a bit older, I realised that was, you know, quite scary. You know, writing about pop bands is not that scary. But yeah, no, I didn't become a journalist until I was 25. I did work at the Llechi Star newspaper in South Wales. I was a Saturday girl and did holiday jobs there. And then went to university and ran a mile from it, really. Yeah, I went to English language and literature at Oxford. And I'd gone to Cosina College in Swansea, who were amazing, pushing us to apply for these places. And I went there and suddenly it was quite terrifying. And I did one music review and then didn't do any more because I was too intimidated by all these incredibly confident people. And basically, I document this in the book, but I had 3 or 4 years of doing random jobs and basically end up making a fanzine with a friend, which I sent to some places, one of which was a magazine, which I ended up freelancing for and ended up working for. So it was because of my writing I got into these jobs, but I did not go in a traditional way at all. Yeah, because I just thought, I can't just send my writing off to people. I can't, you know, I knew I wanted to do it, but almost kind of thinking of me as a writer was just too much of a leap. And I think, you know, I still think it's weird, you know, when I call myself a writer, you know, obviously I am. But I think because there's still a bit of, you know, people think that, you know, it's not as proper a job as doing many other things. You know, what's the value in it? What's the worth in it? Of course, you know, I know people connect with my writing now and I accept that and really enjoy it. And I think, well, that's the value in it. You know, people, you know, love the lovely things you said earlier about my book. You know, people see themselves reflected in it. You know, it might answer questions for them. It might, you know, share a feeling. And that's what life's about. That's the important stuff.
And do you think that was the crux of why you felt compelled to do it at those sort of formative years post university? That's the hardest age at which to persevere at something that you love when conforming and getting a quote unquote proper job is much more probably looked upon as acceptable by society. And perhaps, I don't know, how supportive was your mum? Was she behind you in your pursuit of a writing career?
Well, it was
worried for you, I'm sure.
No, do you know what? No, it was almost the opposite of that. I was too scared to pursue a writing career, and my mum pushed me. Right, I remember turning 24 and having this big, you know, crisis. I remember where I was living with my then boyfriend and saying, oh my God, I wanted to be a journalist. I can't do it now. I, you know, I don't know anybody. And, you know, I'd got an English degree. I got an English master's degree. I tried to be a lecturer, do a PhD, and I didn't get the funding, so I couldn't afford to do it. So I was just doing random temping jobs. Oh, I was a medical secretary. I worked for a charity. I did all these random jobs, and I just didn't know. I didn't have a focus. And my mum was saying to me, why don't you just write? You're really good at writing. I was like, how do you do that? And she's like, you know, well, can you apply to a newspaper? And I said, well, I don't, you know, I'm 24, I've been doing random jobs for 2 years. But she was like, you know, you're really good at it. And, you know, it's funny, my mum hadn't been throwing out my childhood, you know, you must write, you're amazing at this. You know, I know she knew I was, you know, it was something I enjoyed and something I was good at. But I think at that point, because my lack of confidence was so extreme, she did, you know, give me a kick up the arse, basically. And that, off the back of that, I started a fanzine with my friend Matt, who I just met in London. It was a fanzine about London, and I was fascinated about the history of the city and all this kind of stuff. He'd lived there since he was born, and we made this thing together, and it was creative and interesting, and that's what got me into it. And yeah, so I think, you know, it was partly my mum telling me to do it. Thank God she did, you know. And I think I got into journalism in 2003 at a time when somebody like me could just get an editorial assistant job in a magazine. I don't know how that would be now. I think it's getting tougher. But yeah, I was lucky, but I always used to think, oh, I was so lucky, I was so lucky. But I had made something and I had put the hours in and I loved it, you know.
The thing I wanted to hone in on, and your book just talks about grief, and not only your grief for your dad, but it also talks about other people's grief and the friends you lose along the way. And so I just wanted to perhaps move forward from that 2003 when you first get that job at The Word to what I believe is the first time you mention your dad in an article which you wrote for The Guardian, which was in 2007, am I right?
That's right,
You mentioned in the book, I like, by the way, how you called it End of Side One. That's a nice touch there. About coming across a mixtape in a shoebox.
Yeah.
And that you took you a while, but then you realised it was actually his mixtape and it wasn't yours. And that propelled you to writing a piece about him for the first time. What I found interesting is the line when you said something you'd long tried to silence. So maybe you could elaborate a bit on that.
Had I written about these things in private? I bet I did. I haven't got any notebooks that have things about him, but I'm sure I would have in diaries and things like that a little bit. Laura Barton, the wonderful journalist, did a column in The Guardian called Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll. And she's a writer who also writes personally about music, and she was on holiday. And the editor at the time of that section asked me if I'd cover for her. And I didn't really know what to do. And then this was like a couple of months in advance. And then I'd gone home and, found these tapes. My mum had found these tapes. And she said, oh, you don't know if these are yours, whatever. And they're really old. And, put one in and then realising these are songs from, when I was really little. And then getting my Guinness Book of Hit Singles, because, the internet wasn't, kind of, that was to hand in those days, the early days of the internet. And then you're just thinking, oh, it's my dad making a mixtape. And it was... it was my dad taping the charts, which is what I did as a kid. That's something that, for people at the age of 35, they might think it's a bit weird, but it was like, it's the only way to kind of have this stuff, because you're not going to just be able to put it on Spotify or whatever.
Yeah.
Knowing that I did this without him telling me to do it, but it was sort of in me from him, was quite amazing. But yeah, making that leap to writing it and then telling other people about it.
Mm.
Putting it in the paper. I remember that day going to get the paper, and I always buy the paper if I have a big piece in it because it's still quite nice to get the paper, and just feeling almost like, oh God, am I going to panic attack or something? Because I just think, oh, it's going to have my photograph on it because it's a column, it's going to have all these words. And also nervous about my mum reading it. I told my mum I was writing it, nervous about other people. But I think it was around the time the chart had just gone to download only, the downloads had been accepted into the chart. God, it sounds so long ago. But it was like I'd released something inside me a bit, and it felt quite powerful in a way.
Was it cathartic?
Really cathartic. It was still quite scary. And it's still sometimes thinking about the fact I've written about my dad. I haven't written like everything that happened or whatever, but I've written so much about it that I feel like I have to protect myself from it sometimes as well, not to get too upset or dwell on things. It felt quite powerful. And then I started to do more personal writing. Some stuff that wasn't about my dad. I did this blog at the end of 2009, the last 50 days of 2009, 50 songs from the 2000s, basically, which is a sort of longer version. Conceptually, it's slightly linked to the book I eventually wrote, but I wrote it and it went out and loads of people liked it. But that was it. And that was about songs and their effects on my life, but different ways, just in that 10 years. Mm. After that, I wrote a piece about male pop figures and me as a kid in Word, and that was like 4 pages long, loads of photographs, stuff about Michael Stipe from REM, who I loved as a teenager, Adamant, George Michael, there were a couple of other people in that. And I really, it kind of was like, oh, it's quite nice to kind of sort of put your life on paper and try and make a kind of sense of it, rather than it just being something that's, swirls around your head and sometimes can feel quite upsetting.
Had your thoughts about your dad been quite internal up until that point? Had you been someone who talked about him and grief in public?
No. I think probably with good friends. I had a friend in secondary school whose dad had died, although she ended up, we ended up falling out. But I could have gravitated towards somebody to whom something similar had happened. Yeah. Boyfriends were aware of it. Maybe not somebody I went with for a fortnight. So maybe, you know, kind of long-term boyfriends, a few boyfriends from when I was young. I definitely talked to them about it a little bit, but not in any detail. Didn't talk to my mum about it. Yeah. Didn't talk to my brother. I wrote a big piece for Elle magazine, which is about grief and memory, actually, which wasn't about music at all. An editor had read this word piece, and then I wrote another piece of them afterwards. And that's the first time I talked to my mum about my dad. So I was, how old was I? 31, 32. Mm. And I also got married when I was 33. My dad died when he was 33. And a lot of these anniversaries were quite hard to leap over.
Very powerful times, aren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, it's hard. You know, you're talking about reading that bit about my son being 5 and a half, thinking about your daughter, you know, obviously with your loss as well, there'll be things that you've come to in your life. And I always think, you know, it's ridiculous, you know, because, you know, just because I've been around for the same number of seconds, you know, as my father at this point, it shouldn't mean anything, but it sort of does mean something because it's a connection.
I mean, for me, it's been hitting the age where my first memories of him are. So my dad died at 52, but my first sort of real memories of him were when I was, I suppose, 6 or 7, and he was 37, which is the age that I am now. And so last year, I just remember looking in the mirror, and for the first time I could see him as I remembered him, because all the photos of him as a young man, I couldn't really relate to because that was pre-me. But suddenly, like you said, these moments where you're suddenly transformed or taken back to that time when you were with that person, they're really powerful moments, aren't they?
They are. And I think when you become a parent, you know, when I say the inspiration for this book is writing that article, but I think deep down is having a child and seeing my little boy and thinking, you know, there's a brilliant book by Philippa Perry, the psychotherapist, about bringing up kids. And she talks about, you know, when you have children, you're thinking of yourself through them. You're thinking of yourself at that age through them, which I never really thought of before. And she goes into it in some detail. And it's so true. You know, my son is now, you know, he's 9. And, God, I remember being 9 really clearly.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're starting to, you know, want to fit in with everybody else, but you're trying to manage all these things about your little personality, and it's very powerful. And if you've had a bereavement such as we have, then you want them not to be vulnerable, and you want them to enjoy everything. Of course, they're going to be vulnerable, and they will have to be at some points. But you know, you want to do everything you can in your power to not make that happen. And you know, that's what's kind of been amazing with my son and music, really, kind of having, you know, when I wrote the book, you know, he's sort of just getting into music, you know, some time has passed now, it's been, God, he's really into stuff. And we found out last night that a singer he randomly heard in a radio program that he's now got a bit obsessed with is playing at the WOMAD Festival this year. We're going, and he's so excited. And it's just, and little things like that. And that's something that he's come to himself, but I know the joy of that excitement about hearing a song that you don't know why you connect to it, but something about it, you know, just absolutely captivates you. Yeah, but it's very powerful. I don't think you have to have kids to have this connection, though. You know, I think it can be, as you say, looking at the mirror at a certain age and spotting your similarities to somebody. My brother John looks very much like my dad. And he has a little girl now, and she's older than he was when he died. And, you know, that made me think a lot about that connection as well. He's an amazing dad. You know, it's just, you want to have a conversation with a person that's not there about it, and you can't. And it's ways to, but listening to music and thinking about music can be a way of really helping yourself with that, I think.
So do you think either that article in 2007 or this book, either of them helped you on a personal level to have those conversations with the people. I think you allude to it in the book. You suddenly asked your mum about the music that your dad liked that you'd never asked her before.
Yeah.
So have these conversations become easier now with your friends and family?
Definitely, definitely. Yeah. You know, I think what's quite powerful writing the book, you know, I was kind of trusting my instincts about what to write about a lot of the time. And I think it's very telling that towards the end of it, I think it's the penultimate chapter, two of the main interviewees are two friends of mine, one of whom is a friend whose husband died at the age of 40. And one of them is one of my best friends who works in dementia care settings and has had incredible experiences with music and people, you know, in very late stages of dementia. And, you know, these two of my best friends, you know, and some, and yeah, I talk, and when I finished, I was going to finish the book with this chapter about, you know, music and COVID and, you know, and myself getting older. And then at the end, I was like, no, I want to talk to my mum suddenly. I want to have a conversation because I know some of the things that dad liked, but actually, I don't know. And she just, we just had this lovely, lovely chat about it. And it's not that we chat about dad all the time now, but it feels like more normal and easy to do that and to navigate things.
Yeah, you alluded to how, and I found this, so a bit of a backstory for you. I've not only started this podcast to help me with my grief, but I've also started writing about dad and I've written an album of songs about him. And that has helped me get to know him in a weird way, because I think the thing I struggled with most was the realization that I didn't really know him. I thought I didn't know him. And that really hurt me. And I think because people often ask you, don't they, if someone's, oh, what were they like? What was this person like?
Yeah.
And I would always struggle with that question, and that really broke my heart. And so having therefore sort of written these songs and formulated him in a more constructive way in these songs has really helped. And I think you said something similar about you had to write him so that you could continue and carry on and make him a formed person that could stand in this book, and then you could carry on with that now in writing. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. It was also sort of learning to accept that, you know, you'll never fully know them in the way you want to, which is a really sad thing, but you can kind of form a relationship with things about them and sort of carry them with you in your life. You know, I wrote another piece unrelated to this book in The Guardian about how I had this sort of incredible revelation one year that on the anniversary of my dad's death, I could do something like really spontaneous and wonderful and just see the 11th of January as a special day where you do something special and exciting. And there's these, when I moved to Wales, I always used to see the Malvern Hills in the distance. I thought, oh, I'd love to go there one day and properly explore. So I went there on the 11th of January with my husband and my little boy before he was in school. And at every 11th of January, I try and do something. And I feel like that's, you know, it's not getting to know my dad, but it's kind of like embracing life and doing things out of the ordinary, things that really give you pleasure. I feel quite spiritual or kind of sort of give you a sort of sense of connection with land or the magic in your brain, you know, kind of these magical connections you want to have with things. That's been a massively helpful thing with me as well. You know, I still will talk to people and they'll say, you know, oh, when your dad liked this, and I'll be like, oh, you know, my dad was a huge football fan, and kind of finding things out like that when I was older, it's like, oh, I didn't know that, and that hurt. Yeah. Again, that kind of hurt, but you know, I know we had this connection over him asking me what was number one in the charts, and I had to find it out. And in that gesture, it's just this geekiness, and there's pop music, and there's something quite sweet about it. And it's thinking about those few memories that you have. And, you know, you have more if you're older, you know, when a parent dies, but they're not necessarily as solid, you know, kind of, you know, the memory's so shaky. Kind of music, you know, songs are sort of, they sort of are solid because they recorded once, they sound like this, and
yeah,
they carry,
and they never, yeah.
yeah, they're never going to, you know, they might, you know, they might be remastered or there's different versions or whatever, but kind of like that version of, you know, Only You by the Flying Pickets or, you know, Freedom by Wham. It sounds the same and it carries all these different people's memories and stuff with them. And it's really beautiful. Mm. But yeah, it's helped me so much. You know, sometimes it's still tough. You know, I've done some podcasts. I've done so many podcasts and interviews, and there are some times when I just find it quite tough. So I try and kind of prepare myself now to, you know, think of them in a positive way, because they, you know, so many people have got in touch with me about their own experiences of loss. And I think when you're making an album of songs that connect you with that person, you know that other people, you know, other people wouldn't have known your dad, but they will have had, so many people have experiences like the experiences we've had, even if we feel very isolated in our own grief, you know, and having a conversation literally through a podcast or writing a book and getting responses to it is just, it's human connection, isn't it? You want to, you know, have that dialogue with other people. You can't have dialogue with a person you necessarily want to have a dialogue with, but lots of other people can have this amazing conversation with you about it.
I liked your line. I don't know if you were describing it in the way that you thought of it or someone else has said to you, but grief is when a dialogue becomes a monologue. And
no, that was me.
That was you.
That was me.
That was
yeah,
a lovely line.
That came into my head and I was like, yeah, it's just kind of like one way. And
do you think that in a way was what you were trying to do? You were trying to fill your dad in with the gaps of what had happened to you, because I certainly feel like that has been a big part of what I've written. And again, I totally agree with what you said about becoming a parent, that these moments have an added weight when someone's not here. And so talking, I'm in a lot of these songs, it's as if I'm talking to him, which can seem quite odd, I suppose, to somebody in one way, but it's like you're checking in with them, saying, oh, this is what's happening to me, or this is what has happened to me since we last spoke.
And you're making something, and you're making a song which will always be there. It's not, you know, a thought in your head that's there 1 minute and gone the next, is it? It's something solid. So you're actually making this thing. It's like a gift to them.
Do you find now with your son, you can open up about your dad a lot more? And is it something you want to do with him? You know, fill in those gaps for him?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I write in the last chapter of the book about when he finds out about my dad. You know, he was 5 and he found a photograph in my office, and I felt so upset because I was really worried about when to tell him, and I didn't want to not tell him, but I didn't want to just go, oh, by the way, 5-year-old child, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he found this thing, and he was completely random and not intentional. And then we had a little conversation about it. But I remember when my mum remarried and I have a wonderful brother, James, which I can't imagine my life without him. And that's a really odd thing, thinking of my dad's death, you know, because my dad hadn't died, he wouldn't be there. James wouldn't be there.
Yeah,
I remember telling James when he was about 6 or 7, you know, he kind of had found a pic. You know, my mum did have some pictures of my dad up. And, you know, I just talked about him with James a little bit. And I think doing that with my son now is similar. You know, I feel sad that I've had to, you know, we've had to confront mortality with him at a young age in a way. But then again, you know, I don't ever want to pretend that these things don't happen. And
I think kids have a weird way of just, I don't know about you, but my daughter's, their introduction to death is often through Disney films, you know.
And oh God, there's too much of it, isn't there?
And it's usually I'm the one that's crying, and then they're like, what's the matter, Dad? They've just died. It's okay.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, Disney
films. They seem all right. It's us adults that are carrying the baggage, I think, yeah.
It's like parents in Disney films, a parent always dies in the first 5 or 10 minutes, or the parent is dead, isn't it? I know. Yeah. Actually, the other day we were watching them, my son went, oh, not a dead parent again. And I was like, oh God. But, you know, he's at that age now. He's kind of like taking these things in and kind of, he could contextualise them a little bit. But yeah, we talked about things. Very sadly, my father-in-law died suddenly last summer, and which was a hell of a loss. He was the only couple of months after my book came out, a really wonderful, wonderful man. So we had a grandparent dying very quickly. And, you know, the thing that I think is important is just to talk to kids about their feelings. You know, we didn't talk really about my dad when I was little. And, you know, and I'm not, you know, saying, you know, I wish my mum had, but, you know, cause they were sort of different times. My mum had, she was 32, she had two kids, you know, and it was, you know, and he wasn't, you know, it was something that happened during an operation. It wasn't meant to happen. She must have been going through it. And, you know, the thought in those days was like, oh, you don't upset the child, do you? Yeah. You just want to, you know. And I just remember really wanted to talk about him and wanted to get in touch with him. And I remember Father's Day, kind of wanted to I made a little card and I wanted to put it on a balloon, you know, and all this stuff. You know, all this really tough stuff. And I think the important thing now is just to talk about it. You know, Evan, my son, can come and say to me, you know, really miss Grandad. And we have a big cuddle and say, let's talk about the lovely things about him. And his granddad used to do lots of drawings for him. They're all in his room. But I'll also not kind of like, I try to answer questions simply and not with loads of detail because I don't want to dwell in death. I want to kind of, you know, kids are funny as well, aren't they? One minute they'll say, so how did your dad die? And then you'll say, and then I'll say, oh, who's your favourite Pokemon? The next question. You know, it'll be like that. So it's kind of letting it answer the question for them rather than answering the questions for yourself.
Yeah.
Not using your small child as a sounding board for all your, you know, grief, I guess. But
I think one thing that comes through this book, even though death and grief are huge parts of it, is what you've just alluded to there. It's the celebration of living more than anything. And I think that's what I try to grab onto in my songwriting, is that expression of hope and looking forward and clinging to the joyousness of life. And I think that is obviously something that you try and do as well, am I right?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, that's something I think writing it now, you know, well, I'm 45 now. It's like, you know, starting to kind of think, oh gosh, you know, I'm definitely an adult now. But, you know, it's that kind of feeling that, you know, I'm a lot older than I was when my dad died now. And, you know, I'm getting to the age where a lot of my friends' parents are poorly or dying or need looking after. And just trying to kind of manage that in a way that harnesses the joy of life at the same time, you know. And you know, if you have had a bereavement, it, you know, and sometimes can be very easy to kind of, you know, kind of not, well, wallow, I guess, in grief a little bit, because grief can be comforting. It's something, you know, you understand. But it's trying to work with yourself to, you know, think, right, what would they want me to do? What can I do that is celebrating the lovely things about life, that and really try to focus on that rather than the loss. And, you know, having conversations can obviously help that as well.
Definitely. So has making this book given you the bug, the appetite to do more writing of books? Or do you think you'll stick to the music journalism for the time being? Or what's the feedback been for you? And has it made you feel like you want to do more?
I feel like, you know, I don't know how you feel about this, but kind of making, you know, I've made a book that is, to, as I say in its, at the beginning, is to my dad and to little me. It's having that conversation I wanted to have. And there are still maybe more things I'd like to say to my dad, but I don't feel like I need to write another book about it or do anything like that. You know, that is done and I'm proud of it. And I want to do other things now. But I feel like that book was always, I always needed to get that out of me. Once I was writing, I was thinking, God, this, I need to get this out of me. I don't know if you feel the same way about the album, but it's like, make it something creative out of that. You know, all those years of feelings just was incredibly powerful. Hard, you know, I bet you've had hard times, but, you know, it's kind of, it feels very special, really.
Yeah, I think like you, I for a long, long time stayed silent on it and not wanted to talk about it, never brought it up in interviews, didn't want, in my eyes, it was like I didn't want the pity from people. I didn't want that to sway how people thought of my music. I wanted the music to stand on its own, you know, how silly that now sounds when I say it as an older man, but... And it was a bit like you stumbling across the mixtape. It was clearing out the attic and of my dad's house and finding all his stuff that I'd just put in boxes because my mum and dad had divorced. So going through all those things and then realizing, that I had a lot of conversations that I hadn't had with him that had things that I wanted to say and discovering things. And it, like you say, it's been a real catharsis and and also, yeah, an underlining as well, and a feeling that I can now move on with my life having said these things. A bit like you say, though, it's scary to do, and it's scary to think of other people listening to it, but hopefully, I'm sure you've found in the responses you've had to the book that people can resonate, even if your stories aren't exactly like theirs, that people resonate with the emotions that you've gone through.
Yeah, they've felt similar things, or they've, you know, that kind of disconnection, or, you know, those sudden moments where it all comes rushing back, and times when you feel numb, and, you know, these are the way lots of us feel. And, you know, it's sometimes reading somebody's story that is quite different but shares a sort of emotional connection, but, you know, the facts are different, can be actually quite helpful. But yeah, it's been amazing. You know, I've had, you know, I had a 75-year-old widower who didn't know much of the music in the book emailing me about it, which was amazing. And just like he said, you know, who liked classical music, but he understood what I was talking about. And I've had, you know, younger people, you know, I have to, you know, a lot of the people who have been really have got it are people who are around, you know, 5 years either side of my age, because, you know, it's that pop music connection through the years, certain bands and stuff like that. But yeah, it's been a really wide spread of people in terms of music tastes, which has been fantastic. Like Cozy Fanny Tutu, you know, she was in Throbbing Gristle. You know, she was like, oh my gosh, yeah, this made me think of this. And, you know, people who are really avant-garde and people who are really full-on cheesy pop, you know. I was like, yes, because that's my music taste anyway. It goes like that. But you know, it's music in whatever form touches people in really amazing ways. And it is about emotion. It absolutely is.
And so to finish off, the podcast is called Feels Like Healing. Does music still feel like healing to you? Does it still have that power over you?
Yeah, definitely. This sounds really...
Does writing still feel like healing as well?
Oh, it depends. Sometimes. Oh, yeah, if I'm trying to write an article and I've got a deadline in 4 hours, no. yeah, it's funny, right? That's something I had to kind of get over. It's like writing for myself versus writing for work. Music definitely does, and this is going to sound a bit navel-gazing, but I made a playlist to go with the book, which literally is all the songs in order. I should pin it to the top of my Twitter profile or something, because lots of people ask. And I did spend a lot of time last year when I was in the car on my own putting the whole playlist on shuffle and trying to sort of, and just having these odd songs from my past pop up. And I found it really amazing. You know, not all of them are deeply profound songs, you know, because, you know, Mr. Blobby is in there because it reminds me of my little brother's obsession when he was three. But yeah, there's loads of different things. So you could have like something that's an acid house track next to some, you know, modern classical composition or whatever. And that felt really healing. And you know, I'm writing some fiction at the moment. I don't really know where it's going, but I feel I've got the same kind of excitement about it and this feeling in my chest. And it's rare to get that kind of, especially when you've kind of got, you know, you're still battling with confidence and things about writing I still find quite tough. When you have that feeling and you think, I have to write this, it's such the most, it's amazing feeling. And I get the sense that you might have had that too, you know, making your album, you know, I have to do this, you know. And you might not always feel like that, but if you'll have these moments of feeling like that, it's really exciting because you know something good is coming out of it, something new.
Yeah. Well, thank you for taking the time to talk to me, Jude, and thank you for writing your book and sharing us your story. The Sound of Being Human is available from all good bookstores, and I thoroughly recommend you go and check it out. Thanks, Jude. Diolch yn fawr.
Diolch yn fawr. Thank you so much, Al. It was lovely to be on.
Please help by rating and subscribing to this podcast, as it will help to spread the word about Feels Like Healing. Thanks for listening.